Welcome to the Barnyard with Steve Robertson. As always, I am your good friend and host, Steve Robertson, here on the Monday edition of The Yard. Hope things are well with you wherever you are today. We'll be heading down to Hoover in the AM, and we'll see what happens, obviously. Missouri and Ole Miss playing game one. A lot of SEC tournament talk on today's show, but we'll be there. And we look forward to being there. For young Jacob Bain, this is his first trip to Hoover in the SEC tournament. So, and that's been fun for me, too, to be honest with you. I've been doing this, man, goodness, coming up on 30 years. And, having Jacob travel some with me for baseball has been fun. But also, too, I mean, I don't get to listen to podcasts as often, but it's kind of made it all new for me again. You know what I mean? It's like just, you take all these trips and sometimes you take it for granted. You do. And to see kind of the wonder and glory in his eyes, and it's incredible. In the short year and a half, 2 years he's been with Gene's Page, he's already been on 10 of 16 SEC campuses. I think the only people that can say they've done that more is me and David Murray. That's it. And so we get out and go because that's what this fan base expects and demands, and or at least they should. So we look forward to being back in Hoover. And if you've never been to the SEC tournament, let me encourage you to get out and go. They do a tremendous job with that. They really do. It's really fun to watch on TV, right? But being there, it's even better. It just is. The SEC gets it right with the Hoover Met. They do a great job facility-wise there. A lot of great merchandise there. All kinds of stuff, man. It's just, they do it right. And we get together and celebrate the sport, and we celebrate our league. And it's nice seeing everybody there, right? Not just in the college baseball media, but there's just a lot of fans you see there, and you kind of get to know people. And so if you're on the fence about going, let me encourage you to get off the fence and go make some memories with your children, your friends, your significant other. It's all up to you. Yes, there is some weather in the forecast, but we don't worry about that. We don't plan to stay long. Right? I don't know who sang the song, but so many of you have made it a meme out there. We're not here for a long time, but we're here for a good time, right? Or the other way around. We're here for a good time, not a long time. We don't have a lot to gain. We'd like to go win a game or two, but we're not going to be able to play our way into the top eight. And maybe we move up a seed line or two. We'll talk about that some later in the show. But I won't say that the tournament is meaningless. It's not. But we really don't have a lot to gain, and we don't have much to lose. Because I think we're pretty much locked in where we're going to be. That's how I feel. And again, maybe you get a little more of a boost if you make a big run. But I don't know if that's best for our postseason resume. We'll see. Let's thank our friends at Bulldog Burger Company. And I told you guys that I would have Bulldog Burger Company for dinner last night. We did. I had the smash burger again with the fries. We didn't get the spring rolls. So if you see me in Hoover and I look a little peaked, part of that is, life on the SEC road. But also I didn't get my spring rolls last night. I don't know why she chose to go that route, but maybe she wasn't hungry. Or maybe she's looking in the mirror and she feels great about how she looks. I don't know. But we both had the smash burger, and she had it with the caramelized onions. I did not. I had the fries. She had the onion rings. We had a great time. And what was left of the fries and the onion rings, the dogs enjoyed that too. So it was a feast for the entire family last night. I do enjoy that smash burger. The smash sauce, I guess is what they put on there. I just like it. I don't just eat for nourishment. I eat for enjoyment, and I enjoy eating Bulldog Burger Company. And I suspect you do too. Three great locations to serve you: University Drive in Stark Vegas, Gloucester Street there in Tupelo, Lake Harbor Drive in the Ridge and Flowood area. And again, have the spring rolls as your appetizer. If they served them for breakfast, I'd get up and have them in the morning before I went to Hoover. I've got appearances that I have to keep. It's true. An image we have to protect. But nevertheless, you can take care of your own beauty care regimen, right? Add those to what you do in life. And get that chocolate shake to go. You can ride that ride home with a smile. Bulldog Burger Company, the place where people go to meet. M-E-A-T. All right. Let's take a look at the preview. Now, again, we'll get back together on Wednesday. Probably be in the evening. We'll see. But we'll get back with you on Wednesday. So we're going to kind of pick some games here. We'll probably kind of jump ahead a little bit, you know. But we talked a little bit about this on yesterday's show. As you guys know, as we mentioned, Missouri and Ole Miss. Now, what's interesting, you know, about this matchup, because, again, granted, Missouri is better than they were last year. But they're not great. Right? They finished dead last in the league, right? And there are some people that think Missouri may make a coaching change. Other people are like, no, they're going to give it another year. You know, I don't know. I like Kerry Jackson, but I also understand, too, this is not a popularity contest. But the Tigers finished the regular season 23-30, and of course, you know, lost the last three against Texas. But you know, they went into the month of May with a legitimate opportunity to finish about 500. They didn't quite get there, but they did show some progress. 23-30, and you know, again, you remember that weekend we went up there last year. I mean, they were so bad. They were 16-39 last year. And so, yeah, they've made progress. Progress, not perfection. And listen, let's be honest. They're not really committed to baseball up there. And Kerrick Jackson is a good coach and an evaluator of talent. They just don't have any NIL money to work with. But, yeah, I mean, on a neutral field, they're 6-1 this year. Now, granted, a lot of that was against HBCUs early in the year where they were just trying to stack some wins. But, you know, again, you go back and you look at, like, you know, the SEC schedule for them, it wasn't a joke, man. And again, they get swept the first weekend against Auburn, but then they go to Tennessee. Guys, they won game one. They won Friday night in Knoxville against Tennessee. Then they get swept by A&M. And those games were largely not competitive, especially the second two. And then they go to Kentucky. And they went on Friday against Kentucky. And Kentucky's a team that may sneak into the tournament. You know, Nick needs the chalk to hold. We don't need one-bid leagues turning into two-bid leagues. But again, there they are again on Friday, winning the game. And then somehow they got swept by South Carolina, which kind of assured them of being last place. And that happened in Como. And those games were competitive. They just couldn't get it done. You know, and you get a little bit deeper into the season, you know, it's like, they guys, like even Arkansas here, right? They lose game one against Arkansas 5-4. Lose game two 6-0. Well, they bounce back to win game three. So, I mean, that's a competitive series, right? I mean, basically, one half inning determined the winner of this series against Arkansas. You know, they struggled considerably against the top half of this league. But towards the bottom end, like the, you know, the weekend against Vanderbilt, you know, that crazy game that was, you know, delayed by fog. They win 8-7, they lose in 11-8, and then they win to take the series. And then they finish up with Texas. And so, again, Ole Miss and Missouri haven't met in the regular season. But it's hitting the Missouri team of last year. And people say, Steve, are you telling me Missouri's got a chance to beat Ole Miss? Well, they absolutely do. Am I expecting it? No. Is it possible? Yes. And I don't just mean mathematically. It's possible. Not to mention, Ole Miss is going to throw Will Liberatt, former Missouri Tiger. It makes a lot of sense to me. He knows them. But you know what else? They know him too. Don't be surprised if it's a competitive game. Don't be. But again, I expect Ole Miss to win. Now, Kentucky-Vanderbilt. Now, this is an interesting one for me. Now, Vanderbilt finished 12th in the standings. Kentucky finished 13th. All right? No doubt about that, right? Everybody kind of agrees the numbers are the numbers. But then when you begin to dig a little deeper here and you begin to look at, you know, the metrics, right? If we get, and a lot of people are expecting to get Kentucky into the tournament, they're 34 in the RPI. 34. Yes, they've had Some challenges at times in the midweek, but they are 34 in the RPI with a strength of schedule of 29. It's true. They went 13-17. Now you get a little bit deeper here and you look at this Vanderbilt team. RPI for them, they finish a game ahead of Kentucky in the standings at 14-16, but the RPI is 73 with a strength of schedule of 52. A non-conference strength of schedule of 137. That's Vanderbilt, right? So I am certain that there are going to be some people that advocate for Vandy and Tim Corbin. And I think the number one, I think it's almost impossible to do that with that RPI where it is. Like, I think Vanderbilt has to win the tournament. But, you know, they could move up maybe in the top 40 if they just make it to Sunday. That understood, I don't think Vanderbilt deserves to be in this tournament. Again, the totality of the season is what has to be judged. There are relationships that matter in college baseball. We all are aware of that. And now, what the best part of this, if you're Nick Mangione, and you're not, but if you were, you control your own destiny here, right? You beat Vanderbilt, then you remove that as a topic of conversation. Now, Vanderbilt went to Kentucky earlier this year and won 2 out of 3. Kentucky won game 1-5-2, and then Vandy won 8-7 and then 13-6. So, again, like most SEC series, one half inning kind of determined the winner of the weekend. But Nick and the Cats can make things a lot easier on themselves by just simply winning the ball game. You win that ball game, then you remove the possibility of Vanderbilt making a run through the tournament at Hoover. Because Tim Corbin wants to win this tournament every year, not just this year. He wants to win it every year. It's not just because of the fact their backs are against the wall. They've been planning their pitching plans and their strategy for this for weeks. Weeks. And now here we are. So if Vandy wins, they have to play Florida. I don't know how motivated Florida is going to be. I know Florida has representation on the committee. Florida State and Florida are both kind of right there around the 8-9 line. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And you know, on this show, we absolutely believe in taking care of our mental health. The month of May is a reminder that whatever you're going through, you don't have to go through it alone. I tell you guys all the time, everybody needs somebody they can tell everything to. Life's a journey. Some days are good. Some days can feel overwhelming. Whatever is keeping you up at night, it's easy to feel like you may have to figure it all out by yourself. The truth of the matter is, no one has the corner of the market on good answers. And no journey should have to be taken alone. Having someone with you to listen, to understand, and support you can make all the difference in the world. Guys, I've had so many challenges in life, right? Guys, 2022 was a difficult year on me. And I relied on people that I trusted. And that's a network of people that I built up over decades. But the reality of it is maybe you feel a little alone with whatever you're dealing with. That's where BetterHelp comes in. Quality therapists that will work according to a very strict code of conduct. They're fully licensed in the United States. There is also the therapist match commitment. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. There's a short questionnaire that helps you identify your needs and preferences. And our 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means we typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from all of those tailored recommendations. You don't have to do it alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com. So I think Kentucky can do the SEC, the NCAA Tournament Committee a favor, like just by winning two games. You beat Vandy, you beat Florida. It makes it easier to put Florida State in the top eight and Florida out. Makes it easier to leave Vanderbilt out. And again, Vanderbilt's just kind of clinging by a thread. But you could make things easier for everybody involved if you're Nick Mangione by just simply winning tomorrow. And if you can somehow find a way to win in game two. I don't think anything beyond that's going to change. If Kentucky makes it, they're one of the last three seeds that goes in the field, right? But I know there's going to be some people that are going to advocate for Vanderbilt. Well, they've had this and they've had that and had all these injuries. That's part of the game of baseball. I think Vanderbilt has to win the tournament. But I would like to see the Vanderbilt streak end. That's just my feeling. All right, game three, South Carolina at Tennessee. Now, again, South Carolina absolutely has to win the tournament, right? There is zero chance that South Carolina is going to get an at-large bid. It's not going to happen. Zero. Zero chance of that happening. Tennessee, I don't think that Tennessee can really play their way up. You know, there's some other people out there that may disagree. I think the hay is in the barn here. I mean, you didn't finish above 500 in the league. There's no chance to host. And I think you're probably a solid number two with an RPI of 31. We'd like for that to get better, right? We would. We at Mississippi State change those quad three, two losses to quad ones. Be great. We expect Tennessee to win this game. And, the Gamecocks, 7-23 in the league, right? And just hadn't been good. And I'm just kind of curious to see what they're going to do there. It's not going to be Monty Lee. I just don't believe it. And I think he's a good coach. I just think you need a clean sweep, right? You just need to start fresh. And so is that Kevin Schnall from Coastal? Is it time to move on from Coastal? I don't think this would be the last opportunity for Kevin Schnall to have an SEC possibility. Just don't see it that way. Guy's a great coach. Played for a national championship twice. Just hadn't been able to get over the hump. But his stock may never be higher than it is right now. And so maybe they go that route. That's the safe route. If you want to go maybe the kind of the wild card route, go get Coggy from Georgia. Because the thing that I know about Coach Coggan is that he would have a great portal class even without having to spend a lot of money because he knows how to evaluate players. And so I think they wouldn't challenge for much next year. I do think they would be a much better team, and they'd be a team that would be difficult to compete against. Probably don't finish in the top half of the league next year, but I can promise you that Coggan could make South Carolina a team that would wreck somebody's season. That just when you think you got it all figured out, they show up and take two out of three and just knock your pitchers all over the ballpark. But, we need 10. We got three wins over South Carolina and three losses to Tennessee. If we could get Tennessee to win that game and eventually kind of keep creeping up the RPI a little bit and help us move those quad two losses to quad one, I think that would be of some significance. LSU and Oklahoma. Guys, you know how much I respect LSU, and I love beating LSU. And early back in the summer, I had somebody that spoken to Jay Johnson that told me, Jay's a little concerned about this portal class, a little bit. A little concerned about the portal class. And eventually, when you're as reliant on the portal as they are, eventually you're going to get, a handful of turds. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It did. It did. It was worse than anybody expected to be, though. They finished 14th in the league. You go from being the national champions to being 14th in the league. I thought LSU would take a little bit of a step back this year. Never thought it would be this. Never. And it's not like they did have some injuries, but it's not like that their entire pitching staff was just wrecked with injuries. They just didn't have some dudes. They got some younger guys they depended on that stepped up and assumed weekend roles, and a couple of those guys did good at times, and other times not so much. They got to play Oklahoma. Now, the one thing that I'll tell you about Oklahoma, they can pitch it, okay? They may not always have, a frontline ace. They had Kyson Witherspoon last year, who was outstanding. How absolutely outstanding last year. And we beat them. Pico beat them in Norman. And so they didn't have a lot else with that, like, you know, like real ultra-talented guys. But they were right there. And that's the product of good coaching that Skip Johnson gives, right? They're going to be well-coached. They're going to get better as the season goes along. And that's one of those things I think you got to go back and look at. Now, Oklahoma won the best 2 out of 3 series in Baton Rouge. Now, game one, Tigers got them 7-1. But then, Oklahoma wins 4-2, 4-3. That's kind of the Oklahoma Skip Johnson special, right? They know how to formulate a plan to kind of neutralize your offense. And they get just enough offense themselves to win games. Don't be surprised if Oklahoma makes a bit of a run in the tournament. I don't just mean the SEC tournament, but that if they win a regional somewhere, they're going to travel. But don't be surprised if they win a regional. I don't think they can get to Omaha. I do think they win a regional. And so that's how tomorrow's games kind of lay out. And so, again, kind of looking at this, we're going to pick Ole Miss. We'd love for Missouri to win because our two favorite teams are Mississippi State and whoever's playing Ole Miss, right? But I do expect Ole Miss to win. I just think Ole Miss is too much offensively. Kentucky and Vanderbilt, I know what this game means to both of these skippers. If it was deeper in the week, I may pick Vanderbilt. But I just feel like Nick Mangione is just such a Bolshevik, man. You know what I'm saying? Like Nick is just one of those guys that, like, if I only had to play one game against him, I'd be worried. I'd rather play a weekend against Nick. But when it's one game, backyard, bare-knuckle brawl, he scares me because he's going to pull out all the stops. You know, you're not going to have the benefit of Friday and Saturday to plan to win on Sunday. You just got to show up and put up your dukes. And Nick's the kind of coach that wins those games. And so maybe it's my heart, but I'm going to go with Kentucky beating Vanderbilt. And from an RPI standpoint, that doesn't help us. I do think Kentucky can be an at-large. I think if Vanderbilt beats Kentucky and then loses to Florida, it might hurt us in the tournament as a league. So it's probably better for Kentucky to win this game. I do think Tennessee takes care of South Carolina. And again, I think if you're Mississippi State, you want Tennessee to win. And you'd love for Tennessee to go on a little bit of a run here and get that RPI in the quad one. You'd love for that to happen. And what's interesting is they win this one, then they get Arkansas. It's always a wild game when those two teams get together. And this Arkansas offense is just very average. And in that big ballpark, I think it works against them. I could see Tennessee getting to Friday. You take care of South Carolina, you knock off Arkansas, and then you take on Texas on Friday. That could be interesting. LSU and Oklahoma, I got to go with the Sooners. I just think LSU has packed it up. I don't think Jay Johnson has any magic in the bag at this point. I think Jay is just absolutely ready to get into portal evaluations and start reconstructing the team for next year. I think they're ready for the season to be over. And I don't know that I would have ever said that about LSU baseball. I really thought early in the year when they had some – I still figured out. It's LSU. It's Jay Johnson. It's a great program. It's a great – they will figure it out. Well, they didn't. And, of course, there's a lot of people that have this revisionist history. Well, you could see it coming. You know, in the midweek when they started stacking up some losses, you started thinking, well, you know what? The pitching depth may not be what we're accustomed to from LSU. It's true. But now you look up and they're 14th in the league. It's crazy, man. It's absolutely crazy. And then, like, again, if I had told you beginning of the year that LSU would barely be in the top 70 in RPI, you'd never believed it. They're 29-27. So, at best, they're going to play, you know, game, lose one, be 29-28. Finish the year winning record for what that's worth. You know, they got a strength of schedule of 10. And a 9-21 record in the SEC. 4 quad 4 losses. They're 4-19 against a quad one. Think about it. Just that metric alone. That LSU is going to play 23 games against a quad one and win 4. It's craziness, man. It is. And I just don't know how motivated they are to go play a baseball game. And again, we didn't play Oklahoma. We got three wins over LSU. You know, so the longer they run, the better it is. But there's a lot of pride in that uniform, and I'm sure there'll be some rallying around Derek Correll and those guys, because those guys are loved. And like, they're going to feel like, hey, we know we got to go win this tournament. And the thing about it is, and this is what's so crazy, is if LSU decided we're going to really go play hard here, I could see them winning a game or two. I might could even conceivably see them getting to Saturday. And what I mean by that is, you beat Oklahoma, then you got Auburn. Auburn, probably throwing a midweek guy. Maybe you can get him. And then you get to game eight, and you get LSU and A&M again, and you know those guys, you played them recently. Of course, A&M trying to play their way into a top eight. I just don't think there's a lot of RPI opportunity along the way. And, of course, they're paired up. In the event that they win game eight, they would play the winner of Texas and whoever they play. And you know Texas would love to be able to play Texas A&M in that big ballpark. And so, again, I think that works against the Aggies. But more on that later. But just kind of looking ahead to Iron Day on Wednesday. Of course, we will play, no matter what happens tomorrow, game one on Wednesday. I like us to win either way. And the truth of the matter is, if we win one, I'm thrilled. If anything beyond that, I don't know that it helps us. You'd love to beat Georgia just for the RPI hit. And a little bit of revenge there. But I want to get home and rest. Okay? And that's the thing, when you begin to kind of work through all of this, you begin to kind of think, okay, if you can win the first one, then you can just throw your rotation. And our guys have been Thursday, Friday, Saturday for 2 weeks, right? So everybody's like, hey, do we move Valinkas up to Wednesday? You start him a day early, but then, of course, the next week he would throw on Friday. So then you move him back. You move him up a day this week, and you can move him back 2 days. Maybe that makes some sense to me. Do you throw Ryan McPherson? I don't know. But I don't think you go up to Hoover looking to win the tournament, because you're trying to set everybody up for the regional next weekend. But, yeah, I'd love to win, to get another win over Ole Miss and then get a win over Georgia. I'd love it. But honestly, and you know how what happens, we get so caught up in the moment, you just want to win. But right now, with no emotion in the moment, I just want to go get a win or two. And I'm thinking, win one, lose one, come home. Give everybody the weekend off to rest and get ready to host a regional next weekend. That seems to be a good plan. I never go into any athletic competition expecting to lose. But if that's the way it plays out, it's not a bad thing for Mississippi State. It's not. We got bigger fish to fry than the SEC tournament. And again, growing up and even as a young sports writer, I was like, if we're going to play the game, we want to win it. I would want to have some momentum going into the regionals. And I think now that everybody makes Hoover, and we used to be an 8-team tournament, now it's 16-team tournament. You know, everybody's in tournament now. I think in some respects it's lost a little bit of its luster, because so many of us are just kind of planning to try to go chase a national championship. It's not what it once was. And that doesn't mean it's not great. It is. But as we discussed too, there haven't been a lot of teams that have really gotten on a run in Hoover and dramatically changed their projected seeding in the NCAA tournament. There are teams, obviously, that have played their way into the field, and there have been times that, and like I think of Ole Miss more recently, playing their way into a regional hosting opportunity, but they were already hot coming in. It wasn't like they were just kind of skating along and then had a great week in Hoover, and they're like, oh, well, let's give them a host. Ole Miss was already trending in a great direction because Mike Bianco had led them to a very eventful month of May. So they were already had a full head of steam by the time they got there. But everybody talks about, hey, anything can happen, but not much does, right? That's the thing that nobody – they don't tell you that because that, you know, that hurts the marketing efforts of you guys to watch it. You just never know. Well, you know, we've won the SEC tournament before and really just not so – saw no appreciable impact to our seeding. And that's been when we've been really good, and times when maybe not so much. But it's important to understand that there's a lot of good baseball that's going to be played here in the next few days. And we hope to see you out there. But when we get back together on Wednesday, afternoon or evening, whatever that may prove to be, we'll work through where we are. And we'll recap the game and hopefully preview the next one against Georgia. That's the hope. But I certainly don't want to go over there and lose to Ole Miss. And for that matter, I don't want to lose to Missouri. I want to at least win game one. I think you guys feel the same way. Regardless of who we play, I just think that one more win gets you to 40. And that's the thing. You win the first one, and even if you lose to Georgia, that's not going to be a huge RPI hit. But you win one and then lose one, you end up pretty much right where you were in the RPI. Save a spot or two. Like right now, we're 12 in the RPI. I think you win on Wednesday, you might push up a spot, maybe two, maybe. And then if you lose to Georgia, who is currently behind Mississippi State, you're basically contemporaries when it comes to RPI. So you're not going to have some huge drop in the RPI. And one game rarely ever does that this time of the year because you got to balance it against the totality of the situation. But it's all very important. But one more win certainly wouldn't hurt my feelings. I'm sure you guys feel the same way. And I certainly don't want to lose to Ole Miss. Absolutely not. And I think it's one of those things, too, that there's some people that are kind of invested in kind of keeping hope alive for Ole Miss. But I've done the numbers on this. Did it myself. Didn't just accept somebody else's research. But there's never been a 15-15 team since we expanded the field in 1999. There's never been a 15-15 SEC team host an NCAA regional. And that's where Ole Miss finds themselves. And you see people out there, well, there's this. And guys, it is what it is. And maybe at some point it'll happen. But it hadn't happened yet. And this isn't the year to do it. Not based on the parity around this league. It doesn't make a lot of sense to have a 15-15 team host this year. I just think for Ole Miss, they kind of got going a little bit later than they wanted to. Of course, you know, we swept them, and I said on this show and others, Ole Miss is a better team than people feel like they are today because State swept them, and you think, oh my gosh, it's going to be terrible. They're not a bad team, and they are a team that's certainly capable of winning a regional as a two, but the chances of them hosting are absolutely minuscule, if at all. All right, it's time for today's top 10 list. It's brought to you by closewithblair.com. That's C-L-O-S-E with Blair, B-L-A-I-R.com. Blair Chandler, my friend, your friend, our collective friend in the mortgage industry. And you never know when you're going to need a mortgage guy. Save his number on your phone, 601-500-2344. 601-500-2344. You never know when you're going to have the need. You may forget the name. You won't forget the need. You can check your phone. Oh, wait a minute. I already have a mortgage guy. Yeah, it's one of those life hacks they never tell you about when you're coming up. I'm telling you now. Get his 25 years of expertise and know-how working for you. He knows how to construct loans to give you the best chance to get to the closing table. He understands the ins and outs of underwriting. If you're not ready, he gets you on a plan to get ready. For many of you, the dream of home ownership has eluded you. It may have been you had the wrong circumstance. Maybe it wasn't the right timing. Maybe you had the wrong loan originator. So whether it's your first home, your next home, or your retirement home, or perhaps that game day condo, which may prove to be more affordable than you think, Blair Chandler, the only name to know. Check in with him today. Call or text direct. Blair Chandler at closewithblair.com. Okay. 9 years ago today, we lost Chris Cornell. We did. 9 years ago today, of all the celebrity deaths, none have hit me harder than that one. For those of you that know me well, you know I've got a lower leg, left leg sleeve of Chris Cornell. I do. Happy to show it to you when we're around, provided I'm wearing short pants. Not all of us look good in shorts. I do. So I thought to honor Chris's memory today, and we've done so many Soundgarden and Audioslave and Chris Cornell solo joints. What could we do? Well, I thought let's go back to the beginning. Now, this segment is going to hurt the feelings of some grunge aficionados or self-proclaimed experts in grunge. I'm perfectly okay with that because, as I say many times, if I step on your toes, I hope it hurts. Okay, many of you, and I love you, even though you make my head hurt, many of you have TikTok brain. And what I mean by that is everybody jumps on TikTok and they record these videos and they're not rooted in truth. And all of a sudden that becomes the accepted narrative about what really happened. That's just not true. So I thought let's go back to really the genesis of grunge. You know, we've talked about before the Malfunction album with Andrew Wood and his brother was recorded like in 1980. You know, grunge didn't really hit until 91. So let's go back to the Sub Pop era of Soundgarden, even that predates the debut album Ultra Mega OK. They had two EPs, Screaming Life and then Fop. Screaming Life was first. Eventually, Sub Pop, which despite the narrative that many people had, they really were not necessarily people of great integrity. It's been romanticized, but they were a fledgling music label that really struggled. They were very small time. People act like, oh, Sub Pop was, they were very, very, very shoestring. Very. And so these albums, the first being Screaming Life, was actually recorded in 1986. Wasn't released until 87 because Sub Pop didn't have the money. Yeah. And then eventually, of course, Soundgarden left and went to A&M. Not Texas A&M, but A&M Records. Now, some of these tracks were first recorded in 1984 and then released in 80, or recorded some in 85 on a demo tape back on April 24th of 1985, 6 years before grunge broke. So again, this is kind of the forerunner. You say, but Steve, I thought, yeah, I know what you thought because you believed everything that you were told. But again, some of the songs that appeared on these EPs were written and recorded way back in 1984. In 1984, Kurt Cobain was in high school. Eventually dropped out, became a bit of a nomad, and ironically, at 17 years of age, he did a short film. And I say it's a short film, it's just kind of this craziness on a camcorder called Kurt's Bloody Suicide at 17 years of age. In that, you can find it, most of it on YouTube. And even then, like, he pours out, like, it's not cocaine, it's probably flour or whatever. He pours that out, right? It's part of this little film that he did. It's supposed to be a horror film. It was really just a bunch of teenage kids running around being silly, but it's got like pentagrams and all kind of crazy stuff, and got a song from the Melvins that was added later, to kind of make it seem a little more notable. But the future drummer of Nirvana, of the Melvins, pardon me, and then Chris Novoselic were all kind of part of this little project, and that's back in 87. And again, I share that because it's important to have the right timeline. 3 years prior to Kurt Cobain and those guys even thinking about doing a band, Soundgarden was already recording EPs. Shared some of this stuff with you before. People reject it because it goes against the reported narrative. But again, in the beginning of all of this, Mark Arm and the guys from Green River, of course the Melvins, Soundgarden, in some respects, Alice in Chains, and then Mark Arm, of course, who later founded Mudhoney. They were just really the forerunners. Andrew Wood, Mother Love Bone. And so there was a scene before you guys were aware that there was a scene. And so it's important to know the history. So we're going to go back to the beginning of Soundgarden. I'm going to give you my top 10 songs off the Screaming Life / FOP EPs. They were later, as I mentioned, that Sub Pop could be unscrupulous. After Soundgarden began to receive some notoriety, after the success of Ultra Mega OK and Loud Love, then Sub Pop decided to release these EPs as one. They remastered them and released them as one album, trying to cash in on Soundgarden's newfound fame. Sounds like a good record company, right? All that understood. Here we go. Number 10, a little bit inappropriate for a title, but it's Kingdom of Come, number 10. Number 9 is actually a cover of a Green River song written by Mark Arm, of course, you know, that did some great things. It's Swallow My Pride. Number 8, and this is an interesting one too. It starts out, I don't know who the minister is, but it's basically, there is like a speaking word part of this that is like from a sermon somewhere. I have no idea where it came from. But the song itself is a banger. I didn't like the spoken word part, but it's Hand of God at number 8. Hand of God. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Number 7, Little Joe. And for those of you guys that know that Soundgarden, you know, goes into the Rock Music Hall of Fame, you know, everybody's aware of that. And they forget that, it's just, we think of the classic Soundgarden lineup, but Hiro Yamamoto was the original bass player. And this is one of the tracks that he put together. Number 6, it's kind of an odd sound, and is one of the longest songs on either of the EPs. It's a track called Entering, and it's very interesting. It's almost eerie at its core, but it's one I think you'll have fun with. Number 5, it's another cover song, and it's FOP. And then there's two versions of this. But again, it just kind of shows exactly kind of what, what the, Soundgarden was into. This is originally an Ohio Players track, right? Everybody kind of knows them for Love Roller Coaster and some other tracks. Fire is a great one. But they covered FOP. I thought they did a pretty good job with it. All right, number 4, and this is one of those tracks that goes back to 85. And again, for many of you, you learned about Soundgarden in around 88 or so. But this is back in 85, before things begin to happen. It's Tears to Forget, and this is one of those tracks, too, I think from a lyrical standpoint, is one of the better tracks from the early days. It only goes about 2 minutes. It's written by Yamamoto and Kim Thayil. But it's an interesting track. Now, number 3... this is a song that was later released. It did not make the initial pressing of either EP, but when Sub Pop, and it's kind of, honestly, it's kind of a, self-serving single. Again, it didn't make the original pressing, but when they did the re-release back in 2013, they included it. It's Sub Pop Rock City. And it's a banger of a track. But it was clearly just like a joke among friends. And it, because it was a previously unreleased song, it kind of drove some Soundgarden fans to go buy this album. It's good marketing, I guess. All right, number 2. Really dig this one, man. It's Nothing to Say. And this is one of those tracks, too, that like when you begin to look at like the genesis of Soundgarden and kind of the classic track of Soundgarden, this is it. Like, you can kind of see the early stages of what this is all going to be. It's pretty good. Number 1 for me, though, and it was on the Screaming Life EP. It was the first ever single from Soundgarden. It was also re-released in 2010 on Telephantasm. Chris Cornell wrote the lyrics. Kim Thayil wrote the song. And here's a quote about it. This song wasn't supposed to be as heavy sounding as it turned out. We just started jamming on the riff, and it took on the noise rock dimensions, kind of a rhythmic thing, and that solo is a noise solo. It's very dissonant. So this was released back in 1987, and you know, it's been on multiple albums, the A-sides, Telephantasm, of course, but it's one of these tracks that was also released kind of as a single back then when we used to do cassettes. And the A-side, of course, was Hunted Down, and Nothing to Say was the B-side. And maybe that's one of the reasons that I like them both so much, is because of the fact it's like the first actual introduction to Soundgarden on a national level. You can find some of the demo tapes that have been kind of copied over, and you can listen to them on YouTube, but this is like the very beginning of all this. It's just one of those interesting tracks, and again, if there was ever a song that sounded like the birth pangs of one of the best bands Seattle ever produced, this is it. It's Hunted Down. Again, if you love Soundgarden, you love Chris Cornell, you're going to put this track on, you're like, dude, I've never heard this before. But this was it. You could see from the very beginning. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting, you know, it was, you know, Buzz from the Melvins that kind of turned Kim Thayil on to this drop D tunings. And a lot of people kind of identified that guitar tuning with grunge, not knowing that Mick Mars from Motley Crue played drop D tuning most of his career. Well, it's most of those bands were influenced by the guitar playing of Mick Mars, the riff master, right? And they will openly say that. And a lot of that, of course, traces back to Tommy Iommi of Black Sabbath. And that's one of the things that I think you saw with grunge, because we had, you know, kind of, we had some rock bands that kind of changed with the times in the 80s, you know, as it became more image conscious and MTV video conscious, you know, bands kind of got away from the darker tracks. And, you know, there's a reason that Nothing But a Good Time was such a hit, right? And so people kind of patterned themselves after that. The Revlon rock era kind of came roaring in. When grunge came, in some respects, it was kind of a return to like the late 70s, early 80s. The music itself got a little bit darker. The tuning obviously got a little bit lower, became more grimy. And I don't know who dubbed the name grunge. A lot of the bands kind of rejected that label. They just said that we're writing rock music. But now it is the genre of music that we kind of identify with that era. But again, I will always advocate for Soundgarden just because of the fact that I think in many respects that some of the modern music media have kind of whitewashed history to fit their own favorites, right? And listen, I'm not a big Mudhoney fan. You know, Mark Arm obviously was very popular within the scene. I didn't think he was anywhere close to the contemporaries. But they and the Melvins deserve a lot of credit for the being the forerunners. You know, obviously everybody knows Mother Love Bone and Andrew Wood, who was born in Columbus, Mississippi, of all places. But Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, those bands, even though Alice in Chains first kind of fashioned themselves as kind of an 80s hair band, and then as they began to go through this metamorphosis, you know, when Lane Staley was in a band called Alice in Chains, kind of like Guns N' Roses, and then Jerry Cantrell ended up joining, they had their own band and kept the name but added the I, and then began to kind of follow in the same vein as Soundgarden. And so I think it's important, again, to know the history and not just accept the fact that everybody that bought a shirt at Spencer's Music knows what they're talking about. We lived through this. And as somebody that is very obsessive about history, whether it be sports history or music history, I think it's important that you know the truth. If you have ideas for the top 10 list, please let us know. Best way to do that is to hit up Roy Samanthi, my friend, at Dogmatic67 on Twitter or X, whatever you call it these days. You can find our great list on Spotify under that same handle. And, you know, God bless the family of Chris Cornell. If you've read my books, it's in all the acknowledgments of all my books. God bless the family of Chris Cornell. It means a lot to me. It was really the soundtrack of my early recovery. And I found a lot of inspiration and a lot of healing, a lot of peace in the music of Chris Cornell. And it pains me to know that we don't have any of it left. Of course, there's still a handful of tracks from Soundgarden that'll eventually be released. And Tom Morello apparently has some old demos and stuff that eventually will be remastered and released. No clue when it's going to happen. And supposedly there's some more things that Chris recorded as a solo artist, just kind of some covers and things like that. They will eventually release those too. So we will get some new music, but it pains me that we're not going to have any brand new music from Chris Cornell. All right, next segment of the show brought to you by Campus Bookmart, a Starkvillian institution. We love Campus Bookmart. Why? Well, they got the things we want. We're not complicated people. When it's gift buying time in your life, buy all the Bulldogs you know more Bulldog merch. Whether it's decorative items for the home, the office, the RV, the car, the pets, or new apparel, you can find everything you need at Campus Bookmart to satisfy the Bulldog fans on your shopping list. And you know what's going to happen? You're going to buy that. They're like, oh, you always know what to get, right? I'm helping you. Don't overthink it. Don't try to get too cute. Don't try to build a better mousetrap. Just buy Mississippi State, folks, Mississippi State merch. The best selection of Mississippi State merchandise, Campus Bookmart. Yeah. So stop by and see them next time you're in Starkville. If you can't make it to town, or perhaps game day is a difficult shopping day for you, visit them on the World Wide Web at campusbookmart.net. And by being a Lawyer Boneyard listener, we'll give you a phrase that pays, and that is BSR, which stands for Beautiful Steve Robertson. That gets you free shipping on all orders over $75. Any order less than $75, absolutely incomplete. All right. Southeastern Conference released their postseason awards today, and that's typically what happens ahead of the SEC tournament. We'll run it down here for you pretty quick. Player of the Year, Daniel Jackson, the catcher from Georgia. And for those of you that witnessed the prowess that he has of stealing strikes as a catcher and helping that pitching staff out, I think you would agree, not just the offensive numbers, which they've been pretty good throughout his career. This year they've been elite. But I don't know that he's a catcher on the next level, but he is an exceptional catcher on the college level. And that Georgia team is going to go, you know, pretty far, I would suspect. And if they get to Omaha, Daniel Jackson will be a big reason why. SEC Pitcher of the Year is Aidan King from Florida. Outstanding effort this year. I think everybody kind of saw it for what it was. Even though Florida at times kind of flew under the radar a little bit, which is weird to think about, right? It's true. It's weird to think about a team with the high profile of the Gators, but also, too, you know, Kevin O'Sullivan, a guy that has huge reputation in this league, no matter what you think, right? It's incredible to think about that aspect of it, that Florida could just kind of quietly go about their business. Aidan King went 8-2 this year with a 2.50 ERA, had 14 starts. And threw a 79.1 staff leading number of innings. Struck out 84, walked just 16. My pick, had I picked for this, if I voted, it would have been Dylan Volantis from Texas. I would not have picked Aidan King, and though I do think he is an outstanding pitcher. So just kind of throwing that out there. But hey, it is what it is. Getting a little deeper here, if I can find it. A lot of tabs open. Freshman of the Year, Anthony Pack Jr. I have no complaint with this. I thought he was outstanding when we played Texas. There is some clutch gene in his DNA. Not only is he a elite defender, he is a guy that can hit for some power, but also good speed on the bases. Going to be a problem for the next couple years. Newcomer of the Year, Aiden Robbins from Texas. This is one of those things, too, that means a little bit more now with the portal. There are more newcomers every year. Aidan Robbins had an outstanding year at Texas. Scholar Athlete of the Year is Gavin Grahovic from Texas A&M. I don't know his academic prowess, but I know that he can swing it. And a Coach of the Year, really no surprise here, Wes Johnson from Georgia. Former Mississippi State pitching coach, Wes Johnson, now at Georgia. They went 23 games in the Southeastern Conference. Outstanding season. They will be a top eight. It's just kind of a matter of debate of where they end up in the top eight. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter that quite that much. All right, running down your first team here, and there are three Bulldogs that made the first team All-SEC selection. Of course, catcher Daniel Jackson from Georgia. First baseman Gavin Grahovic from A&M. Second baseman Chris Hakopian, former Maryland transfer. Banged up against State, just worked as a DH. Chris Rembert from Auburn. And that's a young man last year that kind of began to emerge, and you knew some big things were ahead for him. Yeah, first-team All-SEC selection. Third baseman is Trey Phelps from Georgia, and they actually give us two here. They give two second basemen, two third basemen, and I'm not sure of the actual balloting here. And Trey Phelps kind of plays a little bit all over anyway. Like if you were going to give a utility award, you know, you could make a case for him. More on that later. And then Ace Reese, also first-team All-SEC selection at third base. Shortstop Tyler Bell of Kentucky, who is the leader of that team. We mentioned how contentious this game between Kentucky and Vandy may be. Tyler Bell got ejected in one of the earlier games against Vanderbilt. No surprise here in the outfield. Caden Sorrell from A&M, Aiden Robbins from Texas, and Rylan Lujo from Georgia. And Lujo had a good series against us as well. Your designated hitter, a name you know, Noah Sullivan from Mississippi State. And congratulations to him, too. Yeah, it's been kind of an up-and-down year at times for Noah, but, man, you know, he has come on here as of late. Maybe he's beginning to kind of find the groove. Now, four starting pitchers and three relievers selected as first team. My pick for SEC Pitcher of the Year, Dylan Volantis, your top vote and getter, I think. Aiden King from Florida, and then Tomas Valenkis, who also won the Ferris Trophy today, became the 10th Bulldog to win that award. That is the most of any program in the state of Mississippi to have that many trophy winners. Hunter Dietz from Arkansas, we beat him. That's one game we won up there. And out of the bullpen, Sam Cozart from Texas, former Mississippi State commitment. Walker Hooks from Ole Miss, who had some really big moments down the stretch. I don't know if Ole Miss even gets to 500 in the league without Walker Hooks. He was really good the last month of the year. And then to round out the first team, it's Clayton Freshcorn, who got the big win over State on Friday, got the save on Friday, got the win on Saturday, kind of backed into that win, of course, as the Bulldogs knock him around just a little bit. Jacob Parker with the big go-ahead home run there in the eighth. And then A&M does what they need to in the bottom half and then closes us out. But second team, former Mississippi State portal target Carson Tinney. Texas wins out there. He ends up being the second team catcher. He is outstanding. Didn't do much against us, but he had a big year. First baseman Will Furness from Ole Miss. I don't know. Ethan Bingaman from Auburn, a very talented freshman that Butch Thompson thinks is going to be a star in this league. Well, he already is. Mike Mancini, another former Mississippi State portal target from 2 years ago, second team designation as the second baseman. Jed Udemark, the Ole Miss home run king, makes the second team as the third baseman. Shortstop Colby Branch of Georgia, who is, you know, you look at the numbers, they're not gaudy. He's just a steady player, but, man, he makes all the big plays look rather routine. He's even with Stephen Malam from Georgia as second team selections at shortstop. Three outfielders, including one you know. How about Anthony Pack Jr. from Texas? Yeah, your SEC Freshman of the Year. And then Derek Curiel. And you wonder a little bit, you know, Curiel and Malam were both great, but they were on a bad team. And not as many at-bats, probably, as you might expect, but also, too, not enough wins to really garner first-team recognition. And then Bryce Chance. How about that? Bryce Chance, the former Mississippi State walk-on, a guy that grew up cheering for the Bulldogs, is going to leave as an all-SEC performer. Your designated hitter is Brady Neal from Alabama, a former LSU backup catcher. He's caught a little bit there, too, but really more as a DH this year. Four starting pitchers and three relievers. Cade Townsend from Ole Miss, who has been outstanding this year when he's been healthy. Tegan Kuhns from Tennessee. Jackson Jelkin from Kentucky. And then Tyler Fay from Alabama. The relievers, Jackson Sanders from Auburn. He beat us in a Saturday game or Friday game. Ethan McElvain from Arkansas. And then Ben Davis, Mississippi State's Ben Davis, second team selection. The All-SEC freshman team, this is a very talented group. And the thing that I will say about this particular freshman group, if these guys continue to stay healthy, they are going to be first-team All-SEC selections very, very quickly. Of course, Anthony Pack makes the list. Sam Cozart from Texas. Jorian Wilson, the right fielder from Texas A&M. Had a tough weekend to play it against Mississippi State. But the stuff is good there. Ethan Bingaman, of course, from Auburn. We discussed him. Cam Appenzeller, we talked about him, raved about him on the show before we played Tennessee. It's like if we could get a win against him and burn him in a win, it sets us up well for the weekend. We didn't get any, and Appenzeller got us too. Omar Serna from Georgia, from LSU, he is going to be an absolute problem. Huge series against Mississippi State, even though they lost all three games. And then, of course, Jacob Parker, Mississippi State's right fielder, Jacob Parker. Didn't even get the benefit of much of March, right? He didn't get to play a lot the first month of the season, and then ultimately wins the starting job. And now he's your everyday right fielder. Trent Grenlegger, former state signee, asked out after the coaching change, signed with Tennessee. Worked a lot as a designated hitter, but clearly a guy that knows how to swing it. Miles Upchurch from Alabama. Nico Pardita, who didn't play much against Mississippi State, but did have a big walk on Saturday. We bring in Charlie Foster to pitch to the left-hander, and they pinch hit and put Pardita, and we walk him. I'm not going to relive all that. Mason Braun from LSU, very talented first baseman, had a big series against Mississippi State. He was also part of that collision when Garrick Fry rolls into first base and the throw is wide. And then Jack Bauer from Mississippi State makes your all-SEC freshman team. So a couple Bulldogs there. Your all-defensive team, we did not have a Bulldog named here, but Ryder Helfrich, the catcher from Arkansas, absolutely love his game. Gavin Grahovic, they list him as a first baseman. He plays third base. I don't know really how good a defender he is, to be honest with you. And Mike Mancini from Vandy at second. Eric Guevara from Auburn at third. And then Trey Phelps. Stephen Malam from LSU. Caden Sorrell from Texas as a center fielder. And then Derek Correll. Jason Walk, an outfielder from Oklahoma. And then Hunter Elliott from Ole Miss. And I think a lot of that just, his ability to hold runners and pick people off. And so, again, you run through the list here, and of course, there's a handful of schools that didn't have much to cheer about. But seven of your Bulldogs get some type of SEC designation. Three first-teamers, two second-teamers, and then two all-SEC freshman performers. A lot of hardware, on its way to Stark Vegas. And that is a very significant thing to be in this league, especially post-expansion, and we grew up with eight teams in a league, and now there are 16 teams in a league, but yet your Bulldogs have seven selections for all SEC honors, and that's very significant. And so, we're happy with those, and congratulations to all the recipients. I mentioned about the Tomas Valenkas winning the Ferris Trophy. That's one of the ones, too, that it's a lot of scouts that vote on this. The finalists for that award were Graydon Harris from Southern Miss, and then Valenkas and Ace Reese from Mississippi State, and then Cade Townsend and Judd Utermark from Ole Miss. They have not released the balloting for this, but it's pretty significant considering the fact that Valenkas is a newcomer to the state of Mississippi. But the numbers are the numbers. And again, 9-2 on the year with a 304 earned run average. He struck out 112, and the lion's share of that in SEC play against only 17 walks. Pretty significant. Tied for the SEC lead in wins, second in strikeouts, fourth in innings pitch, and fifth in ERA. 86 batters in SEC play. More than any pitcher in the Southeastern Conference in SEC play. That's very significant. And again, the best thing about that is when you begin to think about next year, as Brian O'Connor mentioned in his speech, Valenkas back next year at Mississippi State. On top of that, Ryan McPherson, also not draft eligible. Duke Storm, not draft eligible. Charlie Foster, we'll see what Charlie ends up deciding to do. Does he stay? Does he hit the portal? I don't know. It has not been the year that we had hoped for him, but he also is not draft eligible. And then, of course, there's Jack Bauer. So you begin to think about kind of the inner workings of the Mississippi State 2027 college baseball team, and you recognize that this should be one of the best pitching staffs in the country and certainly in the Southeastern Conference, at least from a weekend rotation standpoint. We have got to go find some pieces on the back end. That's really the issue, and kind of the book on this team kind of around the conference is that when you get through a couple of guys, the back end of that bullpen – the decline is fairly steep And that's why we're going to need to make sure in a regional that we get as much as we can out of those starters to save some bullpen arms. And for those of you that know the game well, you understand sometimes it's more difficult to win a regional than it is to win a super regional. Yes, the quality of competition in the super regional is a little more robust, but you could be in a situation where you get in the loser's bracket in a regional and it absolutely exhausts your pitching staff. A super is three games, right? Maximum, right? But if you think about the fact, if you win the first one and then lose the second one, then those people can rest, right? But then you have to win your way back. You can go from a situation where you need to win one, where you've got to win three. And when you start thinking about the prospects of this team and the fact that we have really struggled in the month of May with game three pitching, you can see how it could be a dicey proposition. That's why it's so important for State to win the first two games of a regional, and we have no clue who we're going to play, but we do feel very confident that we are going to play those games in Starkville, Mississippi at Duty Noble Field, and the national projections certainly agree with us. I know there are some of our fans in the self-loathing segment of our fan base that think we don't deserve to host, but that's really more about them than it is us, and certainly about Mississippi State baseball. And more about all of that as we get into our final segment of the show. And speaking of that final segment, it's brought to you by the Stark Vegas Clubhouse, the best place to stay in the Golden Triangle when you're bringing a large group to town, and you should. We stayed there New Year's of 25, had a blast. We plan to do it again sometime soon. You owe it to yourself to make some memories with the people you cared the most about, and it's so great to do that under one roof. It's those in-between moments, those moments in between dinner and whatever you're doing for entertainment that tend to mean the most, because you get a chance to kind of catch up with what's really going on, right? The reality of it is that there's not a lot of places that can accommodate large groups in the greater Starkville area. So whether it's a work group, a friend group, a family group, look no further than the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. Now, Google the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. When you do, their Facebook page will emerge for you. You can peruse all the amenities available to you and your guests, the full-service kitchen, the wet bar, the back porch area, which is fabulous, the fire pit area, plenty of parking. It's an underrated amenity when you consider the possibilities here. It's the old renovated Country Club Clubhouse just 5 minutes away from the Mississippi State campus, out past the Highlands on 182, so conveniently located, but centered out there in peace and quiet, right? Great place to be with your friends and family group. Now, part of that Google search is also going to give you some booking options. You can go Airbnb, you go VRBO, whatever you want to do. But you can book through the Evolve website and use promo code BSR10. That's BSR10, the number 10. To get you 10% off your stay. Be sure and check it out. Make some memories with the people you love the most at the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. All right, to kind of get you caught up, too, on some men's basketball stuff, the Bulldogs picked up some recent transfers, you know, and it's interesting, kind of a change philosophically for Coach Chris Jantz. We have recently added, of course, Indy Okafor from Washington State. That's a player Ole Miss thought they had, and State ends up getting them. And then forward Trevor Reed. Of course, we'll have a brother on the team. And then forward Ashton McGee, a native of South Jones, product of South Jones, native of just outside of Ellisville, was originally committed to Kansas State, wound up at Southern University, and now we'll head to Stark Vegas to continue his playing career. And so there's a lot of people like, hey, you know, Steve, I don't get it. You know, the reality of it is that it appears what Chris Jantz is doing this go around is getting guys that maybe have a higher floor than some of the guys that he's had. And we went out and kind of tried to get some proven competitors, but this time around, we're getting kind of a mix of those guys, but also, too, you know, some guys that have multiple years to play. And this is a guy, obviously, that has connections to the great state of Mississippi. A 6'7", 205-pound freshman that, again, played there for the Jags, appeared in 31 games, averaged about 11 minutes a game, shot about 44%, but about 3 points a game. So you look at that, it doesn't really move the needle that much. But hey, you get a guy in that fits your culture, that has the size and strength to compete. He certainly has the length. We'll see how things kind of progress. But by and large, it appears the portal season is over on the men's side. And if memory serves me correct, that accounts for every roster spot. And again, running it down for you, that's Kendall Sanders, the forward from Utah, R.J. Johnson, guard from Kennesaw State, T.J. Simpkins from Seton Hall, guard also as well, forward Thomas Bassong from Florida State, and then Okafor, Reed, and McGee. So with what you have coming back, it'll be interesting to see how this staff can kind of meld this group into a competitive roster. I've seen some skepticism out there in social media based on some of the portal additions. But, you know, until we get them here, we don't know. Because this time last year, we were thrilled with that portal class. Thrilled. And thought, hey, you know, this is the most talented team on paper that we've had of the Chris Jans era. And it turns out to be the least successful team that we had on the court of the Chris Jans era. You know what you got in Josh Hubbard. And you just need some pieces to work around him. But we're going to need some additional scores. You know, and we'll see what happens with Epps. There's some discussion about all of that stuff, too. So let's kind of look ahead here. I'll give you my top 16. Of course, I'll give you a little bit of kind of what we're seeing out there projection-wise. I guess maybe we'll do that first. Let's do that first, and then I'll share my thoughts on that aspect of it. Well, let's start with Baseball America, just because of the fact that you know, they've been doing this a while, but I think the more credible opinions are over at D1 Baseball. But we will start here. So, D1 Baseball, Baseball America has their top eight is UCLA, Georgia Tech, Georgia, Texas, North Carolina, Auburn, Alabama, Texas A&M. There are a couple disagreements I have with that. But just kind of working through that, your Bulldogs, they have us as the number 13 overall seed paired up against Texas. I think we might like another shot at Texas, honestly, but I don't think that's how it's going to work out. But they project that Mississippi State will host with Wake Forest as the two. And as we have discussed before, you know, Wake Forest is a team that RPI has been somewhat kind to. They're 18 in the RPI, but 6-14 against Quad 1. And so I don't think that would be a bad draw in that respect. Southeast Missouri State, they would be an automatic qualifier from the Ohio Valley, and then Lamar from the Southland Conference. So the Bulldogs would play Lamar on game one, which I suspect would be an afternoon game, and then the winner of Wake and SEMO. So we'll see how that plays out. On the other side of it, over at Austin, not a lot of competition there, but I think it's a dicey regional in some respects because you've got some veteran teams from some lesser conferences that might surprise some people. UC Santa Barbara would be the two. Liberty of Conference USA to be the three, and then Binghamton, the automatic qualifier from the America East. So, interesting dynamic. They have, just real quickly here, they have Southern Miss as the 11. Paired up against Auburn is the 6th, which is certainly a possibility. And they have Alabama paired up with Florida State, A&M paired up with Florida. I'm trying to see where they project Ole Miss to have to go out to Oregon. I don't think that's the case. But what would be interesting if their projections were on par, you'd have four Power Four programs in one regional. That's another reason why I don't think it makes sense. But they would have, I think Ole Miss is better than having to go out west. But they got Virginia is the 3, and then Washington State is the 4. So that could be awfully interesting. They also have Oregon State hosting. I just don't think there's any way that Oregon State and Oregon both host. That's my personal feelings, and I'll get to those, you know, shortly. But I've talked to a lot of people in the industry. I have talked to people with knowledge of the process. And so my opinions may not align with everybody else's, and I'm not here trying to suggest that's the case. But I do think we're more on common ground. The last four in, according to D1 Baseball, is NC State, East Carolina, Kentucky, and Michigan. I would like to see East Carolina not make it. I'd like to see Troy make a run and take that spot, but we'll see how it plays out. They have Troy, Texas State, Kent State, and South Alabama as the next four out. And then the next four is Southeast Missouri State, Purdue, UAB, and Vanderbilt. And there again, there are going to be some people that lobby on behalf of Vanderbilt. Now, looking at D1, they have Oregon as the 16 paired up against UCLA. I think geographically that works, because don't think, especially with travel costs the way they are and the NCAA fitting the bill and all that, that that's not going to prove to be a factor in how the bracket is laid out. They have Georgia Tech up against Kansas. I do not think Kansas hosts, but what's interesting, they have Ole Miss going to Lawrence, Kansas as a 2. If Ole Miss goes to Lawrence, Kansas as the 2 seed, I expect them to win that regional. D1 Baseball has Mississippi State as the 14 seed, with Coastal Carolina coming in as a 2, then Michigan and St. John's. So the Bulldogs would play St. John's and then the winner of Coastal and Michigan. They have our regional paired up with Georgia as the 3 seed. I don't think Georgia is going to be the 3, and I'll explain why shortly. I touched on this a little bit yesterday. But they have Miami going in there. That could be fun. Mercer, that could be fun. And then Bethune-Cookman. That is not a cakewalk of a regional by any stretch of the imagination. Bethune-Cookman won more than 40 games this year. Mercer's one of the best offenses in the country. And then Miami, of course, is Miami. Looking a little deeper here, they have Arkansas headed to Nebraska. They have Nebraska hosting as the 13 seed paired up against North Carolina. Texas would have what I think is a decent regional. I think they may have the strongest number 3 in Missouri State, one of the top offenses in the country. They have Texas, Boston College, Missouri State, Oral Roberts. They pair them up with West Virginia, which they have USC going there. I think USC ultimately host. They have Florida State as the 11 paired up against Alabama. That seems to be relatively possible. But as I said before, I just don't think that Florida State is going to be that far out of it when they've got representation on the committee. Just my feeling. They do have Texas A&M as the 8 seed, paired up against Southern Miss as a 9 seed. And what's interesting, too, this A&M regional is far from a joke. They would have UC Santa Barbara, UTSA, that upset Texas last year in a regional, and then Lamar. And then Southern Miss hosting Tennessee again. I just don't think the committee does that again. Tennessee and Southern Miss played in back-to-back regionals against each other, at least a super and then a regional. And you got TCU and Illinois, Chicago. That could be a wild one. But in our regional, again, I think Coastal, obviously a team that played for a national championship last year. They've had a lot of injuries. Flukie's just kind of rounding back into form. That could be a little bit interesting. I don't think Michigan is a team that you have to truly worry about. But my feelings, and again, these are my opinions based on my own research and also my feelings about what I think the committee may do. Now, I may feel differently Friday after the traffic begins to clear. I may see things a little bit different. But I'll give you, again, kind of my thinking on that. I gave you a little bit of a preview yesterday, but I want to give you my real detailed analysis here in the final moments we have together. Like everybody else, I got UCLA and Georgia Tech 1-2. I think Texas is number 3. That's my feeling today. I think Texas is number 3. I think they are one of, if not one of the most complete teams in all college baseball. I think Texas is capable of winning this thing. I initially had Auburn as the 4 and Bama as the 5, but I eventually flipped them. I changed my mind about that, and because there's two reasons why. Order of finish. Alabama finished a game ahead of Auburn, and they swept Auburn. If you have two teams that are similarly situated, you have to check some boxes, and head-to-head is one of them. When possible, you look head-to-head. To me, that validates Alabama to go ahead of Auburn. Then I've got UNC. And then I've got Florida State as a 7. And I think I'm the only person out there right now that's forecasting them in. Many people are saying A&M. I just don't know that we get that many. top eights. That's just my feeling. I mean, we're getting Texas, Auburn, Alabama, and Georgia, right? That's four of the eight. Are they really going to give us five? I just don't think so. I don't think that's going to be the case. And I think the fact that they have to move Georgia in, even though Georgia is not a top 10 RPI, I think A&M is the team that struggles there. I think they're the team that gets pushed out. That makes the most sense to me because, again, they're not going to give us five because when you've got UCLA and Georgia Tech as a consensus 1-2, right, that only leaves room for six spots. Are you really think they're going to give us five out of six? I just don't think so. You're not going to screw North Carolina, right? And then, of course, there's Florida State, the top 10 RPI, and their AD on the committee. But I have Florida State at 7, Georgia at 8. Now, again, a lot of people have Georgia at 3. I referenced back, and I mentioned this yesterday, last year Texas won the Southeastern Conference, but that Vanderbilt was a top overall seed, which made no sense to me. None whatsoever. So, but there is precedent within this committee, because it's largely the same committee that you had last year, that they are willing to kind of think outside the box a bit. And I think you have to punish Georgia a little bit for that non-conference RPI. Now, maybe they don't push them as far as I do at 8. Maybe they put them at 6 and you move everybody else down. And, of course, Florida State and Florida are both kind of in contention for that last spot. And some people think A&M should be there. I just disagree. I would absolutely take Florida and Florida State ahead of Texas A&M. I have number 9 at Florida. I think Florida had a little bit too much up and down. I think they're the first one to host and not be a super. And I think you pair them up with Georgia. Either way, whether you pair them up with Florida State or you pair them up with Georgia or Alabama, it's going to be difficult. And I'm sure Florida wouldn't want to have to go to Alabama after being swept by Alabama. And again, Florida has representation on the committee. It's true. Nebraska, I think, comes in as the 10. Now you'd say, well, wouldn't you put A&M here? You could, and I'd be okay with that too. But I think Nebraska, again, there's all these grow the game advocates. There's all these people west of the Mississippi that are always saying they don't. They're 2 years ago, I won't tell you who, but an AD from west of the Mississippi said that we should have 8 hosting sites west of the Mississippi and 8 east, basing it all on geography and not on merit. Well, that's not what happened, thank God. But I think Nebraska will host. They should host, and I think they're right there. And then I've got A&M. And then you could have Mississippi State and Southern Miss. Just kind of, you could flip the Alabama schools. You could flip the Mississippi schools. I think one of us, again, as I said yesterday, I think us being 12 going to play Alabama makes good sense. It makes good sense to me. We didn't play them in the regular season. Southern Miss didn't play Auburn in the regular season, and I think that would be a lot of fun. Again, looking at this thing right now, you know, State is 12 in the RPI. Southern Miss is 13. Southern Miss is not going to have an opportunity to have any RPI climbing opportunities when it's all said and done. The only team that they could potentially play in their conference tournament that gives them a decent win is Coastal, who is 6-6 against a quad one, right? Behind them, I've got Oregon, West Virginia, and USC. Now, I spoke to one of our friends at D1 Baseball, and they said, hey, we're just kind of taking a stand on this USC thing. And they got one win against a quad one. Yes, they have a top 10 RPI, but we're going to take a stand here. Now, D1 Baseball doesn't see the tournament, right? But I respect the fact that they're willing to say, you know what, we're not going to pretend this didn't happen. We're not going to pretend that USC, you know, just kind of played a horse hockey non-conference schedule. Now, you can't pick your conference schedule. You can pick your non-conference schedule. And that's one of those things that I think as we work through this thing, I think you have to really be honest about that. And again, Oregon State is 17 in the RPI. They can do nothing to improve their situation because they don't have a conference tournament to play in. But if you look just ahead of them, like if you just go strictly by RPI, right, they're 17 in the RPI. Ole Miss is 15-15. There has never been a 15-15 SEC team host. Not since we changed the schedule back in 99. It's never happened. So you remove them. Then you remove USC. Well, then all of a sudden, Oregon State would have a top 16 RPI. That's interesting to see, right? However, they're 2-3 against the Quad One. There is no way that you can give a hosting opportunity to a team that played five games against a Quad One. Now, granted, they don't have, you know, a conference to work within to prop up their RPI. So they have to play a lot of games on the road. But how many years are we just going to be okay with that? You know, and again, I want to just run this down, this whole thing about USC. Because the RPI is great. The strength of schedule is 32 overall, non-conference is 100. RPI of 8, right? 1-10 against a quad one. They don't have any quad four losses, but guys, they play 39 games against a quad three and the quad four. That is brutal, man. That is brutal. 11 against a quad one, you win one, and then you're 5-1 against a quad two. So you are 6-11 against quad one and two, and then the rest of your schedule is quad three and quad four. And let's just start with that. Pepperdine, right? Used to be a college baseball power back in the old need-based aid era. RPI of 218. Well, you picked that series. Then you got Loyola Marymount, who went 12-44, RPI of 287. You picked that too. Now, you played Rice, and hey, that's not bad. Rice went out there, and good for David Pearson doing that, RPI 75. Then you're at Cal Poly for four. And again, you picked that, RPI of 80. UC Irvine, the Anteaters, kind of falling on hard times, 25-27, RPI of 127. And then you got Illinois. You don't pick that, but RPI of 86. Then you got Long Beach State, 17-35 is the record, RPI of 248. You pick that. You pick San Diego, they went 20-30, RPI of 209. Northwestern, conference, 152. You double up, play San Diego State again, RPI of 101. Cal State Bakersfield, again, a team that you picked it, 21-32, RPI of 235. Washington went 22-31 this year, RPI of 169. You did play Oregon State. I give them credit for that. It's a nice non-conference game, and they lost it. Yeah. Then you got to go all the way across the country and play Maryland. They take 2 out of 3 from an RPI team of 81. You do put UC Santa Barbara, and that should be an annual series. In fact, if I'm USC, I make it home and home. Then you get swept by UCLA. Swept. Then you go to UC Santa Barbara. So there's your home and home. So that makes a little sense. But you lose that game too. You get Iowa with an RPI of 62. You win all three of those. And you get Long Beach again. You travel to Long Beach and you lose to an RPI team of 248. It's like you look at this. The math doesn't make any sense. Then you travel to Nebraska, RPI 10. You get swept there. Cal State, traditional baseball power. Things have kind of fallen on the wayside. They're 23-30. RPI of 114. You get Purdue, the Fighting Ross Highfields went 34-18 with an RPI of 54. Irvine again, and you get Rutgers. RPI of 110, Cal State again. Nevada, RPI of 160. And then eventually you play Oregon on the road and lose 2 out of 3. So again, there's just no way that you can make them a top 8 even with an 8 RPI. And the fact that they have an 8 in the RPI tells me the algorithm needs to be tweaked a little bit. I just ran down the full schedule for you. That's it. And none of it makes any sense. They went 20-10 in the Big Ten, which is not a great baseball conference. And against the better teams in that conference, they got beat. That's the thing. You got to punish them, right? You get a non-conference RPI of 100. There's no way that you can give those guys, a top 8. And you'd say, well, you know, see, there's some other teams out there like Georgia Tech. It's got 174. Yeah, Georgia Tech went 45-9 and won the ACC, which is the second best baseball conference in America. It's crazy. It truly is. And so, you know, but again, as far as we go, to kind of get our talking points out there, Again, you win a game in Hoover, you've won 40, no matter how it shakes loose. You don't have a bad loss. You're 26-0 against the Quad 3 and the Quad 4. And then you're 13-16 against Quad 1 and 2. So, yeah, we'd like a couple more wins there. But the reality of it is this is a team with the 7 SOS and 12 in the RPI. State is safely in there. If you lose to Ole Miss, who's RPI 15, you might drop a spot or two. But that's it. You beat Missouri, you may move up a spot, and then you lose to Georgia. And you might even stay where you are. So all the metrics favor Mississippi State. And I get it. You know, you're going to get 7 host spots, and you know Arkansas is not going to be one of them, even though Arkansas beat us head-to-head. Arkansas's RPI is 25. It's just too much to overcome. They got those 3 early quad 4 losses, and that's kind of hung on them like an anchor. So that's where we sit today. When we get back together on Wednesday, we'll talk about what happened Tuesday and obviously Wednesday morning out in Hoover. And we'll just kind of plot the rest of the week based off that. But like all of you, if we're going to play the game, I want to go win it. But, you know, the thoughts of like running all the way to Sunday, I just, you know, and exhausting everybody in the heat, it's not anything that really entertains me. But the more important aspect of it is even if we win this tournament, I just don't think that we will be able to do enough to become a top 8 national seed, right? You say, but Steve, we're 12, right? We're 12. And all of a sudden you beat Georgia. Well, the problem with this aspect is right now Mississippi State is already ahead of the 3 potential teams they would play in RPI. You're already ahead of Missouri. So that's not a big RPI climbing opportunity. You're 3 spots ahead of Ole Miss and 2 spots ahead of Georgia. So there's just not a lot of room for upward mobility when you begin to kind of break it down that way. So, yeah, if you get deeper into the weekend and have the opportunity to play some other teams, you might get a point or two there too. I just don't think it's going to be enough. You cannot ignore the totality of the season and just base it on a week. It just doesn't work that way. And I know the metrics respond to the latest game, but the committee is going to look at the full resume and not just like who was hot. And of course, you know, we went down there in 2024. Everybody said we needed to win a game. We won 2. Yeah, we won 2 games and then ultimately lost 2 more. And then our RPI just drifted out of the top, out of the teens to like around 20. And so it's like every time somebody said, oh, just one more, the reality of it is we could not overcome those 4 quad 4 losses. We don't have them this year, but it wouldn't hurt my feelings if we found a way to go win one and then figure it out from there. Well, best of luck to you guys. Let's have a great week. But until next time, let's all live our lives in a way we make more friends than enemies and people can see a difference in the way we live.